attention.
Welcome back to the Elio Sideshow. I'm a co-host, Frank Gebhardt. I'm joined by Patrick Cortland, and we have a special guest. We kept telling you last week that this was going to be a special episode, and finally,
we finally
have Randall on.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Trump or Biden.
No, it's Randall.
Oh,
come
okay,
on.
All right, cool.
Yeah, we've been talking him up for 2 seasons. Randall, I kind of prepped you by saying I'm not going to introduce you. So can you give us a little bit about yourself so that give the listeners some buy-in so that they are going to pick up what you're putting down later on in the episode?
Yeah, no problem. Well, hey, it's good. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been in law enforcement for a little over 12 and a half years at this point. Been on SWAT for about 10 years. Prior to all that, I was in the Marine Corps for 6 years, Marine Corps Infantry. So I kind of gravitated more towards the SWAT element. That was kind of what drove me to get into law enforcement to begin with. So I think that's what we're here to talk about tonight.
That's right. We are here talking about the tactical alphabet.
Tactical. Tactical is almost like going to 5-Eleven's website and buying a pair, like a clothing set, like each day of the week you work. That's very tactical.
Listen,
it's kind of kind of worn out at this point.
They look good, and they stretch.
So you, Frank,
let's not go off on a tangent there.
See, your name is Frank 36 Hours in Gebhardt, but it should be Frank quote unquote Cop Nerd Gebhardt.
Yeah, I really did go Cop Nerd.
Or 5-Eleven promo.
Are they sponsoring you now, or what?
This episode is brought to you by 5-Eleven. Heck no, I don't think they care about us here over on the sideshow. Well, thanks. So, Randall, you're saying you got 10 years of this SWAT experience, and that's what we're here to talk about tonight. And I think that it's especially relevant with teams being used all over the United States or in the world. And then, and I would imagine that a lot of teams across the United States have been initiated or deployed a lot more over the last couple months since the George Floyd incident in some of these major cities. Is that correct?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, most definitely. I think a lot of the teams right now are probably utilized more this year than they have been in recent memory. You know, and not necessarily in a role that they're used to, or maybe not a role that they're necessarily best suited for. But they do play a vital role when we start talking about protests and riots and things of that nature.
Yeah. And one thing that's pretty cool, and we might get into it later, but because we're talking about it now, is because you all are a specialized team, your team might be out of sight and out of mind during planned protests. It's not like you guys are going to be on the front line. You might be, and your some of your vehicles might be there, but sometimes you just nobody knows you're there, but you're there.
Yeah, we don't. A lot of times, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have us out and be in the forefront when we start talking about protest or riot control, just because. Usually, the mere presence of us, you know, more militaristic looking, you know, mm-hmm. with an armored car and, you know, heavily wearing all the heavy duty armor and fancy weaponry, you know, mm-hmm. that tends to attract negative attention and potentially force a situation to become more aggressive just by us being there. So typically, we don't like to show up to those events and let ourselves be seen until we actually have to be there for some sort of operational reason.
Cool.
There'll be other ways we can help in plaincoast capacities, but as a whole, we're not going to be on the line with an armored car.
Right. You're part of one of those special teams.
That's right. So, and that's what we're going to get into.
How about one of those special teams that uses Microsoft Teams?
He's not that special.
I'm not that tech savvy.
Oh, okay.
So I purposely withheld this from you. I have a pop quiz for you, Randall.
Oh, geez.
Shoot.
Okay, so here we go. I'm just going to go down through this list, and I'm going to see if you can tell me what this acronym or initialism is. Okay.
I got by the way, there's like 14 and I got like three right.
14?
Yeah. Listen, this is why I didn't give it to you. Okay. All right. Let's see if you can do this. S E R T. Pass.
Yeah, it's like special emergency response team.
Oh, there you go. There's he got it. What about, and you know, QRT?
Yeah, it's quick response team.
SRT?
Special response team.
Oh, Jesus.
SOG?
Special operations group.
Oh, my God.
SWAT? He's going down. He beat you already.
Special weapons and tactics.
SRT?
You already said that one. Look, no, I said, three and six are the same.
Oh, yeah, I did. Okay, all right. The trick question. All right, TRT.
Tactical response team.
Wow.
Ooh, I got a hard one for you. And I think I got this from another European agency, ERU.
Emergency response unit.
Yep. SRG.
Special response group.
Jeez. Really you're nailing this. All right. What about a TOU?
TOU. Tactical operations unit.
Yep. All right. We're 11 here. We have five left. TRG.
Tactical response group.
No, but that's what I would have guessed.
Again, this is agency specific, but this one had it labeled as a terrorist response group. But
I should have known that. I apologize.
What about STAR? STAR.
Oh.
He's not going to get T. Because I would have guessed what he's probably going to guess for T, but I didn't get the one.
I freaking love STAR. You know what it reminded me of is Resident Evil. They were the STARS team.
Ooh. Relic Corps. Special training and response. Or special.
Ah, close. We had special tasks.
And rescue.
Oh. And rescue.
Yeah.
And then we have CIRT.
CIRT.
Ooh. Yeah. It's getting harder.
Something incident response team.
Yep. Critical.
Critical incident response team.
Yeah. And he actually got 14 because that's what he put for the 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
TRG, tactical response group. You had that.
That's impressive.
So what are we talking about? 15 out of 15. That's an A. I'll take that.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's impressive. I know I wouldn't have gotten that much, but so, and with all of those, I mean, we're just talking, and basically SWAT, I think SWAT kind of
encompasses all of it.
Yeah, yes. It's your more generalized term that, you know, the public is going to recognize.
Yeah, and you know, it's the whole special weapons and tactics.
And it's very similar to that movie with LL Cool J, right?
Oh my goodness, it's like, it's so accurate, it's ridiculous. It's, you know, it's basically what I went through in training, except it's not at all.
All right, so the police word of the day or word of the week is special, because Randall's special. I know, I'm sorry. But it's special, because think about it. All these groups that we just named I actually even have the definition and I'm glad that we can't see you right now, Randall, because we might see your head go outside the screen, because it's defined as better, greater,
oh God,
or otherwise different from what is usual.
That's probably the best one.
Yeah, I'll go along with that.
but this is where we're coming. And, you know, I'm going to get into it quickly here for the case of the week. And again, basically this whole episode, you know, the reason why we have these these tactical teams is because you have increased training, you have drilled more often, gone through the repetitions, and that's what makes the team special, which makes them better able to handle incidents that that normal patrol officers wouldn't be able to handle.
Yeah, so. I mean, you couple that with a lot of equipment that the average patrol or average officer does not have access to, which is, you know, heightens the level of safety and abilities of what we do.
Yes. So let's get through this case of the week here. I'll kind of just take us right through here, and then we'll talk about it at the end. So this week I chose the estate of Smith v. Marisacco, which is a police county. Yeah, Marasco.
Wouldn't it be like Marasco?
Marasco.
Right?
Thanks, Patrick.
We know Frank's not good with
names. Oh my gosh. So no, I think he just added an extra A at the end. He said Marisacco.
Marisacco. Okay, it's a 2002 case. All right, so this Smith is the guy who ended up passing away, and so his estate filed this claim. But basically, Smith is a Vietnam veteran, war veteran, and former police officer. And he's up there in age, you know, obviously if he was a Vietnam War veteran and this is a 2002 case, you know, he's up there in age and he's had some mental health conditions and the officers know this. One night officers, responded to that house, our Smith's house, for a neighbor complaints. When they knocked on the door, there was no answer. So sometimes we do what we do, and we walk around the house to see if we can make contact by knocking on a window or a back door in case somebody can't hear us. And when they did that, there was two officers. One officer who went around all the way to the back, when he was looking in the window, saw a red light. And he just figured that Smith was inside, and it was he was recording them and had it was a little recording light. However, the second officer, saw that on his partner's chest there was a red dot, and we all know what that means, right? Well, we think we know what it means. That he's got a stinking laser trained on the first officer, and it's not just any laser; it's a laser attached to a gun. So they activated their SERT, their CERT team. And they established a perimeter. You know, they wore their normal getup, their gear, which is, you know, they're similar to, I guess, for the average listener. You're talking about heavy vests that can take shots from
camo,
a rifle. Yep, camo, probably camoed out. Yep. So they established a perimeter. They arrived with various weapons like SWAT teams do. They even had a helicopter for overwatch and then snipers. Now, we'll let Randall get into some of this and why they do what they do, but this is what happened there. So they shut down access to the house and they held the scene until a warrant was obtained for ag assault and other charges relating to what happened against Smith. Once the arrest warrant was signed, they attempted to communicate with him. Family members tried to, I guess, intervene, but the team commander said to just stay away, and they did not use their help. And they finally ended up forcing entry into the house. The case says that they used rocks, tear gas, and flashbangs. But when they went inside, there was nobody in there.
Wait a second. I don't know if anybody else is tracking this. They filed charges against him, and he wasn't even in the house.
Just hold off. And then days later, they found his body 200 yards from the house, and they found out that he died from a heart attack, and they were able to trace his death back to the day of when the officers were out there and the SWAT team made entry. So the family filed suit and brought up three things that the state did wrong. And the first one was that they violated the Smith's Fourth Amendment rights because they had an unreasonable amount of force. And two and three were that they had state created danger by storming the house, and basically their tactics increased the risk of his death. But basically when this all got hashed out relatively soon, I want to say the case came to fruition in 2003, so only a year later, they basically said that everything was reasonable, and they lost the case. Or, the estate of Smith lost the case.
Do they think that he was still in the house at the time?
I would go to imagine that probably between the time when CERT arrived and when patrol set up a hasty perimeter, he got outside of the house.
Yes. He just ran out the back of his house into the woods and had a heart attack while all the other stuff was happening.
Man, that's like karma.
Well, so, you know, and this, you know, we've talked about this in the last couple of shows about how, you know, the police are now or have been charged with dealing with mental health patients. And that's one of the things that we're glad to give up to the social workers to do that. You know, people are calling for our defunding. But Randall, do you want to talk about how they brought up the unreasonable amount of force or why? Let me ask you this. How about why did SWAT why did they form a perimeter? Why did they have snipers? Because I guarantee you some listeners are thinking, snipers really for an old mental patient, you know, man, you know, why they have snipers and, you know, why they block off area to the house? You know, can you talk about some of that stuff?
Certainly. Well, you know, there's a whole multitude of reasons why we do a lot of what we do, but inevitably, once we get on scene, we assume responsibility of the scene, and we're going to make that scene as safe as we can for everybody involved, both inside the house, outside the house, you know, and passersby and what have you. So we're going to isolate that property, you know, to prevent the neighbors or anybody else from wandering into harm's way, which is why we established a perimeter. And two, to prevent a situation like this where he's able to sneak out of the house and we're sitting there holding on an empty house for hours on end. So we want to maintain containment upon him, and then as part of that containment, we're also going to put sniper teams out of positions. Now, when they're not necessarily just a sniper team. You're talking a sniper and observer, and the role of a law enforcement sniper isn't just to shoot things. Okay, you know they're trained observers, and they have, you know, high power optics to provide us with, you know, information that we would otherwise not be able to get. So that's the primary use of them, honestly, unless we would get into a more deadly situation as far as, you know, we've been shot at numerous times and things have deteriorated to the point where there's not much other option. But there's a long road to travel before we get to that point.
So when that generates a question. So when you go to sniper school, they're also teaching you how to be like tactical, you know, do tactical observations from a distance. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. They not only get trained to be marksmen, but they're also trained to be observers. A lot of memorization drills that apply in those type of trainings, and just
that's interesting.
Being able to notice differences and after looking at something for long periods of time, and how to notice subtle differences and things of that nature.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Look at that.
What about, why are you, again, I'm using quotes here, storming the house using flashbangs and all that jazz. Can you speak on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, storming the house, there's a multitude of different reasons that are going to drive us to that. That's not, you know, the typical first thing we're going to do. We have a bunch of other protocols that we're going to try to exhaust before we get to that point, and unless there is a triggering event that would cause us to skip all those other protocols. But you know, when we do start talking about, do you want to go into some of what that is before we get into why we would go into the house, or
we might as well, just because we'll end up forgetting about it.
Okay. Well, you know, usually, again, our whole job there is the preservation of life and safety. So, you know, we're not there to hurt anybody. We're there to effectively end the situation with the least amount of violence possible, you know, and hopefully that comes by way of no violence. So we're going to exhaust other avenues of approach as far as trying to make communication with him, trying to reason with him, using negotiators to whatever extent we can, given the level of communication we can establish with the
negotiators,
suspected side.
Negotiators are probably the real responders, right?
I'm sorry?
Any good?
I think he's messing with you.
I you're breaking up, Pat. I thought I heard something. I'm not sure it makes sense. But,
okay, just checking.
But no, we're you know, they are a huge asset to what we do. And you know, typically we're going to get there and lock the scene down, and then our first major effort is to establish communications through various means with the subject inside. With the intent of having a negotiator ultimately get them in involved in some sort of conversation, either be throw phones or cell phones or loudspeakers, or even just yelling back and forth through a hole that we create in the facade of the house, you know, given the situation that we're involved in.
What'd Quentin call it? It was like the box, right? You throw the box.
The throw phone?
Yeah, they actually maintain a phone hooked up to fiber optic cables that they run back to their little command center, and they bring that out and unreel the wire, and then we can get that up to the house through various means and actually throw that device inside the residence, so that way that the person inside has a means to make communications with us. So, you know, we go through a lot of those steps, you know, and give that time to work and let them do what they do best. And then if that fails or that breaks down or that starts to get to a point where it's no longer a viable option, then we'll progress into other things.
Well, there's two things I picked up on so far. The first one's easy. And I think it's what needs to be known is that these quick response teams, these SWAT teams, their special weapons and tactics are there to better preserve life, but they're also prepared for when shit goes wrong that they can handle it.
Oh, most definitely.
Okay. And then the other thing is that I've realized we're going to actually get into this later, but some of these questions that I'm asking you, you know, you're speaking as from your experience, but there's also a bit of what if, just like, and everything in our police job is because you don't have all of the firsthand knowledge, because you're not there, and that, you know, you have different commanders making different decisions, and you know, a lot of your responses are probably going to be, you know, there's so many things you could do. It's just that based upon the information that you're provided, like right now during this podcast, you know, this is one reason why they would do this or one reason why they would do that.
Yes. You know, it's like everything we do in police work. You know, we can go to 100 domestic dispute calls, and every single one of those is going to require some level of a different response or a different tactic or a different way of dealing with that specific situation. You know, and this is no different.
Yeah.
You know, there's no cookie cutter routine to how these things play out. You know, it's like most things when you're dealing with a live person on the other end, you know, they kind of dictate the flow of the story. You know, they kind of get to choose their own path, if you will, as far as, you know, we base our actions off of their reactions or lack thereof. If that makes sense.
It does. So, like I said, we have this like skeleton of an outline that we wanted to make sure that we hit. And so let's just get this over with the brief history. From what I was able to find is basically somewhere around the 50s and the 60s is when the United States started realizing that there was a need for a specialized group of people that were not considered the military, you know, that came from the police force to better handle hostage situations, sniper attacks on towns, and even into that violent unrest. And actually, we can trace it back to Daryl Gates for the LAPD that created the well-known SWAT acronym that we all use today.
That's correct.
So you've been doing this for 10 years, and you've worked all the way from your lowest ranking. I guess, you know, you have your own rank within the team. Is that right? At least our team.
Yeah. Different states and different municipalities do, you know, their response teams differently. The area in which we work, we're a composite team based of different, you know, members from different organizations.
Yeah.
So there's your home rank from your home agency does not apply here. You know, everybody starts at the bottom here and you work your way up through our own internal system.
Okay. And you feel as though you could do everybody's job at this point within a SWAT team and not including the negotiators part, right? Would you feel comfortable everybody?
For the most part, you know, we do have a couple of more specialized areas that I know enough to get by, but I would not, you know, I'm not going to be setting an explosive. I'm not going to be building an explosive charge to breach a door, or I'm probably, you know, I'm not qualified to lay behind a sniper rifle on a live incident,
right.
You know, but outside of that, yeah, I mean, we cross train enough that we can pretty much, you know, fill every role. You may not be the best at it, but you have enough to get by. But we do have, we cross train, and everybody, every member of the team specializes in usually two or three disciplines. So that we can fill a multitude of roles during a live incident.
Yeah, because and this is you know, and where we're working there, you don't have a full-time team. So when a major incident happens, you're calling and having people respond in from all around our jurisdiction. And so you may have to fill and plug holes wherever you have these officers that are coming in.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, okay. we're going to have officers responding from all over the county. So, we kind of view it almost the same way that they view like active shooter response at this point, whereas we're not going to wait until we have, you know, the whole team there to do something. As guys start filtering in, we're going to start piecemealing them out to relieve patrol units on the perimeter to start establishing our own perimeter. And two, that gives me a set of eyes early on the target address from the guys that know the information that I'm looking for. So they can start feeding that back to me faster and in the format that makes it easier to digest. So we can start building the plan faster.
So there's like a constant updated stream of intelligence information coming back and forth between yourself or whoever the commander is and
people
on the scene.
Right. Well, various, you know, through, you know, just radio communications and through, data sharing software that we have.
So over the 10 years, I mean, how much have you seen procedures change as far as how you do business?
Oh, there's been some very big shifts in certain areas of the job. And then there's been some more subtle changes in other areas, but it's like most law enforcement, it's constantly changing and evolving, and you have to really be paying attention to national trends and case law to kind of stay on the cutting edge of what is currently acceptable and best practices.
And I'll probably end up jumping down to that, but that I'm guessing that's all the same too with like weapons. Have you seen weapons change much over the 10 years that you've been involved?
I mean, you start maybe if we go maybe 20 years ago to what they were doing tactics and weaponry wise to now, there's been some very big shifts and a lot of different thought process on what's required and what they thought was required and has since been deemed pretty much unnecessary at this point.
So who is your best practices overseer or your agency, or who is your best practices, where you're getting that from?
Well, most of what we do and most teams that we have communications with and mutual aid packages with utilize the NTOA, which is National Tactical Officers Association. It's a nationwide, actually, I think it's whole North America. They lay out current standards, and they provide training to kind of keep teams, up to date as to what's going on. And they actually promote like new tactics and new styles and are almost kind of a think tank, if you will, to new trends and ideas to kind of better follow current case law.
Are they, are you able to cite what they put out by saying, like, if you ever found yourself in a lawsuit or the team in a lawsuit, would you be able to cite that, hey, you're taking tactics and procedures from NTOA and you're just not some hillbilly town that is doing some cowboy stuff that you think is right? I mean, are you able to cite some of their stuff, or is it just recognized?
I don't know if I would necessarily say cite it. I mean, I'm not that in depth with it, but we do, most of our officers and all of our command staff do go through they offer trainings for leadership and different variations.
I'm assuming you get like documentation and certificates. And
stuff. Right. And it's like every other training you go to, you get the documentation of the course curriculum and the testing and that, you successfully completed it. But a lot of that is again, just to kind of build a standardized level across the team, as far as expectations and that build a certain mindset. So that you don't have two completely different ends of the spectrum. You don't have two different team leaders doing that went to two different schools and they're doing two different schools of thought and they're on two separate pages.
So it's kind of similar to like our recertification of the lengthy ASP training we just had, that, we went through that just to keep updated with the requirements, right, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, with the having an oversight from a certain agency or with us, you get some standard. Yeah, I love how you throw that in there. Your lengthy recertification for ASP probably took 10 minutes. If we're talking about oversight too, or let me ask you this, with the trainings that you've gone around in the country, are you able to tell a difference between a team or a team member that follows NTOA best practices and one that doesn't?
I don't know if I would necessarily say that they follow NTOA specifically, but you can definitely tell there is a wide degree of difference between teams across the United States. And a lot of that comes down to the same thing you find with just traditional law enforcement, where it's budgetary concerns, it's manpower, it's a lot of places don't have full-time teams, a lot of places don't train to the recommended standard number of days every year, and the reasons for that are just it all comes down to money in the end, just like everything else in law enforcement.
And then again with oversight, How does this play into with police policies? Is it easier to have a district attorney that's in charge of the team instead of a individual police department? Like, how do you deal with?
Well, that's something that's going to vary obviously by jurisdiction and teams and states. We are set up, since we are a composite team, there is no home agency. So we are basically run and hosted by the county. And then our oversight comes directly from the DA's office and the attorneys in there. So at every time we would be on a live incident, That's not something like a pre-planned warrant service or something of that nature. They will have representation from the attorney's office there in the command post with us to, you know, kind of watch, keep a watch over. And if we have questions, you know, hey, this is kind of what we're thinking. We're, you know, where do you think this falls in the scope of legality as far as, do we think we have enough to do X, Y, or Z at this point, given the nature of the situation, so that we can kind of bounce that back and forth and have someone who's kind of detached from the actual live incident, review that, from a higher standpoint and determine if that's the right move to make or not.
Well, you mentioned the oversight, and I think Frank touched on, like, when you're talking the budgetary concerns and stuff, where is all the money coming for the funding? Is it all included with the normal, like, departmental budget, or is it coming from other resources, or is it coming from fundraising, or is it coming from?
Yeah, we, again, different teams do different things. Our budget comes from the DA's office, and then we also augment that by doing, fundraisers and things of that nature. And then there's a lot of donations as well. A lot of the smaller agencies and municipalities within the county will actually donate every year whatever they can to help keep the team effective and be able to provide services.
Interesting. I'm just looking over this here. So, okay. Say if tomorrow, I can't hear Patrick. He's just,
can we get to the meat of,
yeah, we're there.
Okay.
We're there.
Why are we calling Randall?
Well, before we, can we go, maybe we're not there yet. What if Patrick wanted to become a team member tomorrow, what are we talking about? What is there any, What could we expect generally across the country as training, fitness level? What are we looking at here?
Traditionally, most law enforcement agencies are going to require you to do a set number of years, on the street as a patrolman before you can even apply for anything like that.
That makes sense.
And that's pretty standard, as far as I know, across the country. It's the same thing with any other specialized position within law enforcement. You don't get out of the academy and get hired as a detective, or you don't get out of the academy and get hired as a SWAT guy. Everybody comes in at that baby step phase one as a rookie patrol guy, and then you're going to cut your teeth there before, and kind of make a name for yourself. And, we're going to kind of vet you and see if you can survive in that realm, before we try to thrust you into a more specialized career field. But then once you've proven yourself and you've met whatever minimum time constraints or requirements that there are, most agencies will open that up for a tryout, and you would submit a packet, basically just a resume as to, what you've done, what you can bring to the table, why you think you'd be a good fit for this. And then, most teams, as far as I know, try out at least once annually. They'll hold a tryout for the team. I know we typically do twice a year, a spring and a fall tryout, so that we always have somebody kind of in the queue waiting to go to school. But then you'll go, and usually the tryouts are almost always going to consist of some form of passing a firearms qualification, meeting a certain physical standards and testing. And then we also do like a memorization test, a listening comprehension test, and then we do an oral interview with, we use a 10 question standardized interview sheet that we use for everybody.
Do you see one of those things that you just mentioned being a harder to overcome than any of the others?
Usually what takes out most applicants is the physical test, the PT portion. And it's really nothing stringent. It's just a matter of guys that, they just have to put the work in to meet the standard. And for whatever reason, that seems to be, I don't know if guys just don't, they look at it and think it doesn't seem that hard until you're out there and you're doing each event back to back to back, or what. That's usually our biggest, that's what cuts the most people.
And the reason, and this, we're talking tryouts right now, but the reason that you even have those standards is that you're not going to be wasting your team's time even being sent to training, which is going to be much more grueling. But I mean, we're not talking about patrol officers wearing soft armor and the normal, you know, 30 pounds that comes with the everyday patrol officer. We're talking, you know, heavy sappy plates, and you know, you're carrying long guns, you're got helmets on. I mean, you have just so much more stuff on. You probably almost have double or even more than double the weight than a normal patrol officer has. There's physical requirements.
Like special QRT tattoos.
They're actually not that common. I do not have one.
Oh, I thought that was a requirement. Sorry.
Well, I think that the people, and again, Randall can tell you that I think, from what I hear is that the team mentality from being on one of these teams and the work that you do makes you so proud, and that you guys are so tight that people want to show that off and remember it and memorialize it.
It's like anything else in policing. It's a camaraderie.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of things, you know. It's like being on a football team. It's like being in the military. You know, anytime you're on a team that works together, trains together, you know, goes to battle together, whatever you want to say, you know, there is a bond that's formed and a closeness that's found there.
Yeah.
All right, Frank. Can we get to the meat?
Okay. Yeah. So why are we calling you, Randall?
That's a good question.
Right. What he means by that is, like, what are we calling the SWAT team in for? Like, what kind of scenarios? What generates a SWAT response?
Yeah, we can look at this. Like, we typically categorize it in three different things. There's two hard things, and then a third one that's kind of a floater. But your first incidents where we're typically going to see a SWAT team is some form of high risk search warrant, whether that's for our narcotics search warrant, in which we have circumstances that have raised it to the level to meet our standards, which is typically going to be a subject with a violent criminal past, information from informants or surveillance that indicate security on the property, barricades on the property, booby traps on the property, and high probability of violence based on activity that we had seen there. And then all of that would be kind of coupled together to potentially meet a standard or a certain threshold that we would be called out for. Or the other aspect of that is sometimes if we're looking for a wanted felon, and then we can put him in a house, we'll actually get a search warrant for the residence to serve the arrest warrant. And again, a lot of that's all going to be driven on the same protocol there. Is there a history of violence with the person? Is there a high likelihood of weapons and guns or violence associated with the person? And then we look at what kind of security measures are they taking to prevent us from getting into the residence? Is there cameras? Is there barricades? You know, things of that nature.
So, people call to have the team activated, but they're not guaranteed to get the team, depending if...
They're not. We have very specific thresholds that have to be met before we'll activate the team. And that's for everyone's safety. You know, that's so that we are not being sold a certain bill of goods. And then when we get out there, it's us being utilized in a situation that does not require us. And anytime that you're bringing, a heavily armed group of men out there to essentially charge into a house after certain thresholds are met, there's always a potential there for accidents and we can't control who's going to be in the house and how they're going to react. So if we're going into a situation that doesn't meet the threshold for us to be there, and we would go in and the person's inside react in a manner that would cause somebody to get hurt, you know, that's on us, you know, because we shouldn't have been there in the first place. So we have a very specific set of guidelines that have to be met before we can be called out.
I mean, that makes sense. And I think that's kind of where the case of the week comes in, where the estate of Smith not understanding how things work, but that, you know, that you're just not getting, you're just you're not activating this team for just anything.
No,
you know,
I mean,
go ahead.
I can say that, you know, all across the county, when there's an incident that occurs where a department would request the quick response team or a SWAT team, you know, they would call dispatch and request a phone call from one of the command staff, right? And I'm on that phone roster, so I get woken up, you know, 3-4 in the morning on a routine basis to give a phone call to someone in whatever jurisdiction and answer their questions. And usually it's me asking a lot of questions about what the incident is, why they think they need us, and what they've done prior to giving me a phone call. Yeah, and a lot of that, honestly, I get probably over half the calls are turned into a denied response, but that we're not gonna come out for that, just because it doesn't, they haven't gone through the hoops that they need to go through on the chart to get to meet the requirements.
But on the flip side of that, you have heard or read about chiefs or other like agencies around, you know, the county or even across the nation where you said to yourself, they should have had the team called in for this.
Oh yeah. And that's another part of what we do is we also provide training to the different agencies as to when it's appropriate to call us. Because we've seen in 2013, 2014 timeframe, we really saw, at least in our agency here and from talking to surrounding agencies, they kind of echoed the same thing, that we really saw a pretty steep decline in the number of call-outs we were getting. And the best we can attribute that to is a lot of these agencies now are equipping themselves with patrol rifles. They're getting ballistic helmets. They're getting pistol-rated shields in the cruisers. And they're, because they have the shields and because they have rifles and the helmets, they feel more prepared to deal with certain situations. And unfortunately, not a month goes by where I don't hear of an event that occurred with one of the surrounding agencies doing something, and it makes you cringe because you look at the details of the incident and you're realizing you have people with pistol rated armor going up against people with deer rifles that are, you know, barricaded in sheds and garages and so forth. And a lot of times I don't think they necessarily understand the capabilities of the equipment that they have. They have it and they think that it's going to protect them. And a lot of what we do now is trying to get the word out there as to hey, tell me what the equipment that you have is, and let me show you how to properly employ it, and let me teach you what it does and what it doesn't do.
Well, I mean, I guess some of that comes down to them just not knowing their equipment, and some of it might even come down to, would you say, arrogance, where we don't need to call the team in?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of ego involved, especially, you know, in an area like where we work, when you do have so many competing jurisdictions and a lot of them are fighting, you know, they're fighting for contracts with other smaller municipalities. And, you know, they don't want to look at being the big agency that can handle anything. And everybody kind of gets, well, I shouldn't say everybody, you know, certain egos get bruised when they have to call other agencies in to help them. But, you know, we don't look at it. Our team doesn't look at it that way. Obviously, you know, we're not there to stroke anybody's ego. We're there to kind of, you know, again, preservation of life. You know, we want to see everybody go home at the end of this.
Do you have anything, Patrick? I mean, I think we're winding down here. Or Randall, is there anything specific that you wanted to bring up before we start going down?
Well, you know, we got into, I never finished what we do as a SWAT team. Yeah, we just talked about search warrants. But the other aspect of what we do is barricaded subjects. You know, a barricaded subject is really anybody who is police have a legal reason to come out and make contact with you for a variety of reasons. Most of them stem from either a domestic situation or a mental health a situation, or it could be, again, like a going out there to attempt to serve an arrest warrant. And the person refuses to come out, or they fire rounds through the door, or, you know, something of that nature. And then our protocol then would be to lock the building down. And again, we're going to, and then call the SWAT team out, and we're going to come out and you know, just like the case study of the week, we're going to come out and we're going to set the perimeter up, and then we're going to try to establish negotiations, and we'll do different things to get attention to help facilitate those negotiations or prompt the person inside to start those negotiations. And then once that breaks down, we have another variety of tools that are in our toolbox that we can use to kind of elicit a response to try to get that person to give up and resolve the situation. But then ultimately we will get to the point where, you know, it is time to go in. And then there's a, you know, we'll go in, and typically that would be in under gas or some sort of chemical agent. And then to take that subject into custody and clear the residence.
Yeah. And again, the gas is really for everybody's safety, the person inside the house and for yours.
Right. Right. It's something that's there that it's basically going to take the fight out of you, and it's going to create an environment that you no longer have a desire to be in, which is going to be inside that residence. And it's going to want to, you know, you're going to want to come out because you're going to want to seek fresh air and, you know, to ease some of the irritant. So the whole purpose there is space denial in the residence, and then to drive you out of the residence where we can take you into custody and then get you the medical treatment that you need.
I mean, are you seeing that a lot of your, I mean, I guess this would probably be more your barricaded subject. Is it a lot of your barricaded subjects a mental health incident?
Yeah, I've a high percentage of them, majority of them are going to be mental health related.
Yeah, I mean, drugs, or any other mental health.
And most of it involves, you know, the mental health stuff on top of the alcohol, drugs, and whatnot. It creates the, you know, just a lot of times, you know, they end up passing out, and it makes for a long night because you're trying to talk to somebody that's passed out.
Sleeping.
But yeah. So that's, and then the third prong of what we were talking about of our duties would be either for hostage rescue or like active shooter, active killer scenarios. And we're going to treat both of those the same. As far as an active shooter, we treat the same as a hostage rescue. But both of those incidents are usually play off one of the other scenarios. It's usually not a standalone incident.
Okay, so you're still having like a barricaded hostage situation.
Right. It would typically either start as a warrant service and go to barricade, and then something would transpire to make it an active shooter or a hostage rescue situation. You're not typically just going, we're not going to get called out for a hostage rescue unless one of these other two scenarios had already begun.
I think, and this is where, like, just thinking about you guys having to go into this. I mean, I know we do it as police officers, but I mean, with like, you're going into a house, you know, you have this information that this guy, you know, the typical, I'm not going back to jail, I'm going to shoot my way out of this. And you know, you have that in the back of your mind, and you're going through these houses, you know, to clear them and take them into custody. And most times the information, like, again, like with us, with patrol officers, we can, for the, a lot of times we are always looking for that gun, but you guys are being told, yep, you know, there's guns involved here. So, I mean, it amazes me the risk that is involved, and getting a volunteer team to go out and do what you guys are doing.
But I mean, everybody wants to look at it like it's hyper dangerous, like it's more dangerous than what a patrol guy does. And I tend to disagree with that because, you know, we are given the higher level of training and the better toys to come in and play with. However, 9 times or 9.9 times out of 10, we're doing so much more research and surveillance and information gathering on that situation prior to making entry, that we know the schematics, you know, we know what the layout of the house is. We have a really good idea where the bad guy is going to be at. We have a plan to go in. We have contingency plans once we're in there, when things go to shit. You know, we are very well prepared prior to doing those movements. Whereas, you know, a patrol guy, I almost feel like it's more dangerous just day-to-day work, because you don't have that plethora of information about the situation you're walking into. Whereas when we show up to a scene, usually before we're walking into it, we have so much information, it's almost mind-boggling. So you are much more prepared.
I understand like where you might have more time for a warrant service where you could do a nice long workup, but I mean, you're still doing an intel gathering and workup even when you're your quick response roll out to a barricaded person.
Yeah, that as soon as we get the call, like even before the team is activated, whoever the command staff individual is that's taking the phone call initially is getting that ball rolling. You know, we're multitasking and getting our tech support unit to start pulling up schematics and you know, internet pictures and social media, you know, anything you can think of. They're working on that as the team is getting spun up and responding to the location. So usually by the time we get there, I already have a folder of information as to who the subject is, their whole background, the best we can find, you know, the layouts of the residence, pictures of the insides of the residence if we can find them, you know, all kinds of data that it's there's so much data out there available that it's kind of scary how much we can find out about you in a short amount of time.
Yeah, quick time. Interesting. I don't know. Is that?
Do you want to talk about the different disciplines at all that are within a SWAT team?
Yeah, that'd be good, because I think that some of the listeners want to know. It's just not. I mean, you kind of breezed over them without calling them out specifically. But yeah, let's talk
all
about
right.
it.
So, you know, typically, you know, there's it's just like a military unit or anything else, or even think of it like a football team. You're not everybody on the team's the same, right? We have different tasks, and we have different players for different roles. Okay, so this is no different. But we're going to come in and we'll have, you know, everybody kind of comes on the team and you'll start as like a bunker or a cover guy, which basically means if you're a bunker guy, you're carrying a ballistic shield that's equipped with high intensity lighting and a viewport. And then you're going to are assigned a partner who is stays with you, and then he has a rifle. And you guys work in tandem and we try not to split you up, you know, as much as we can.
And that sucker is heavy.
There's different kinds, you know, we have pistol rated shields, which, you know, I think some of the more high end ones that we're getting now are down well under 20 pounds a piece. You know, but, we have, rifle rated shields, which are almost 45 pounds a piece. Wow. And then we have some other ones that are so heavy, you can't carry them, that they're on casters and we're rolling them around.
Wow.
But. So, you know, that's your entry level. Everybody comes on and goes through that initially. And then once you get on, then we have different disciplines that you're going to get assigned to, so you can start cross training. And that's going to be breachers, mechanical breachers, ballistic breachers, explosive breachers, hydraulic breachers, thermal breachers, all these different methods. And you'll go to school to learn those different methods and how to employ the tools that we use to do them. And we'll have less lethal guys. They're going to go into school and get trained on all the various less lethal devices that we have, anything from taser to sponge rounds to beanbag rounds. And then under that umbrella also falls in the chemical munitions. You're, for lack of a better term, tear gas for the audience. But that's usually going to be CS or OC gas that we're going to use. And then there's different forms of that. And whether it's launched from some sort of device or whether it's hand thrown. And then with
the breachers, I mean, I've seen the shotgun breachers. They're awesome. And then I only got to see some of the videos of the explosive breaching, which is awesome. But what the heck is thermal breaching?
That's typically going to be like using torches or using like a welder to cut through something.
Did you see? Wow. By the way, speaking of torch, did you see that Seattle police officer video where the guy threw a torch in the car?
I did. He threw like a 2x4 with a cloth on fire wrapped around it. He threw it through the driver's window.
Wow.
But anyway, so carrying on top of that, then we have hostage rescue team, which is a little bit of its own animal in and of itself. So we'll have a small specialized team within the team that trains extra on hostage rescue. And then, but the entire team is also spun up and receives training on hostage rescue, but we have a small contingent that is like hyper-focused on that and receives extra training days and extra range time. And they work together specifically as a small unit because of the high stress.
Increased risk. Yeah,
because that is one of the most challenging tasks we can be dealing with. And the probability of success in those is so marginal that you have to train your butt off, and you have to be working with guys that can react off one another and all kind of think the same and don't have to communicate. It's a high level operating thing.
And some of these specialized teams are the avenues that you can take here. I mean, it's just not like you get this training and they're done. I mean, rescue. I mean, you're training extra days every month.
Yes. Yeah. They're going to get extra training days. Our explosive team gets extra training days just because of the heightened level of that. Of using those doctrines is so much more. There's so much more liability there that they get. They're accredited. They're given extra days to maintain their proficiency. And this is
where it goes back to you saying it all comes back down to the mighty dollar for
exactly
team training.
Exactly. You know, we actually just had hostage rescue training today. And one of our members is going to be retiring shortly. So we're looking at who we can bring on to that group next. And unfortunately, I have three or four guys in the mix that have been to the training that can come on that are eligible to join. But unfortunately, politics come into play because now I got to look at whose department is going to allow them the extra time to actually do it.
Yeah.
And that's it's kind of sad, but it's the nature of the beast. But then our other specialized team, which you talked about a little bit earlier, would be the sniper teams, snipers and observers. But those guys specifically, because their task is so specific, that's pretty much all those guys do. You know, like they train exclusively on that system, and they don't really cross train on much anything else other than first aid.
Do you have to put your time in as a bunker in order to get into another specialized field?
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to manpower and variability. You know, we typically like guys to come on and do it, a year, 2-3 years to kind of cut their teeth and show what they have and show their ability to adapt and prove themselves as a thinker. Okay. Again, big thing here is everybody on the team has to be a critical thinker and be able to make those command decisions in the heat of the moment and not be relying on someone to tell them what to do. And once they've demonstrated the ability to do that, then we start, kind of pushing them in certain directions as to what we think best suits them or what specifically what the team may need at that time.
I guess, but there's also people that come on the team and are like, I want to be a sniper. And you're just like, slow down.
Yeah, we don't. No one, I shouldn't say no one. We just did for the first time since I've been around, we did bring someone on the team and they did a year as a as an entry guy, and then we allowed them to go over to the sniper sector because we really needed someone over there. And it's, you know, it's a highly motivated individual that really wants to do it, and you know, is excelling in that position. You know, and that's good for us because now I know I'm going to have a solid person there for the next 10 years. That's motivated to do that job, because traditionally it's, that's kind of where some of the guys go when they start getting a little bit older. They don't want to be carrying around such the weight and busting through doors. They'll go out there and do that job. But then we're constantly trying to find a replacement as these guys retire off the team. So
That makes sense. Well, that might be it. So my only question, or my last question, I guess I should say, while Patrick's moving around his mic and sounds like thunder over here.
I'm dealing with the intricacies of the nomad life as we're like living out of one room and moving stuff, and the producer,
you know, my
producer decides that she needs to take a shower or bath or whatever she's doing over there.
My agent told me this was a professional gig. I'm starting to doubt that.
Yeah. Try the moving process. It stinks.
Oh, and by the way, I said a bowl of yellow M&Ms, not green ones.
So oh, yeah. So you're picking and choosing. You sound like a rock star. So my only question to you is, do you still jump when the flashbang goes off?
Oh no, I've had so many flashbangs dropped at my feet that it's a non-issue at this point.
The last one that I was with you guys on, and I'm in a different role, so I'm not part of the team, so I'm just observing while you guys make the house safe and then it's our turn. But I'm sitting there next to a new officer with both of my fingers in my ears, and they're looking at me like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, just wait. I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen. And it scares the crap out of me every single time. Can't get over it. So, all right. Well, we thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
I think, if
any of your listeners have questions, tell them they can hit you up and we can do a follow up, or I can answer some questions at some other time if you guys want any more specific detail. But obviously, we're not going to go into specific tactics of necessarily the full map of what we do. But I'll do my best to answer any questions.
Well, you'll be the SME from now on for anything tactical that we have going on. The subject matter expert. So cool. So you heard Randall. You got questions, reach out to us. We're on Twitter and Instagram. Twitter is @L_sideshow. Instagram is @TheLEOSideshow. DM us if you have any questions. You can also email us at Frank@TheLEOSideshow or Patrick@TheLEOSideshow. Hit us up if you have questions for Randall. He'd be more than welcome to come back on the show and address some of that stuff, because if you can't tell, he's super passionate about the SWAT, the QRT, this special weapons and tactics team. He lives and breathes it, and so he's probably one of the best people to talk to about it. So again, Randall, thanks for coming on the show, and for all the listeners out there, we'll see you next week.
Sounds good. My pleasure, guys.